book of Revelation is highly enigmatic to most readers. It's been known for years. It's been read over and commented on for years and years. And there's so many different opinions. For the most part, it just isn't well understood. I won't say that's the case with us necessarily, but it's difficult. And it can be difficult when we somehow get off on a wrong trajectory, because that happens. It happens with a lot of scriptures. We can have a preconceived idea about what the subject is and then work it from there. I want to talk today about a very revealing chapter. It's one we've talked about in the past, but I want to go through it thoroughly for all of the people who maybe have questions about what it's talking about. Revelation chapter 14 is what many people recognize as an inset chapter. In other words, there's a running narrative in the book of Revelation, and at certain points it stops and goes back and discusses a side topic that's relevant to where they are in the narrative. Revelation 14 is one of those. But the chapter provides something very important to our understanding. It's not a narrative that we ought to dismiss or ignore or downplay in any way. It's important. Now, there are people who have thought that the chapter, at least the end of that particular chapter, is talking about the Battle of Armageddon. And that's the passage that talks about blood to the horses' bridles. I remember hearing that as a young person in the 1950s in our Protestant church. And you'll find many commentaries sort of pick up from that same idea. In fact, so does our own, or did our own. I was having some email conversations with a number of recognizable ministers in our organization. I don't think they were all, I didn't put their names down. I didn't want to because I was sharing this with others. But I don't think they were all from the same organization. There was a consensus that's pretty much wrapped up in what this person replied to me about. And we're talking about the purpose of this particular chapter, where he says, and keep in mind, this is a minister, someone who is fairly scholarly. He says, "I have just received your letter that you shared and want to make comment. In the third paragraph, it is stated that the WCG organization, the blood to the horses' bridles with the Battle of Armageddon," in other words, it's connecting the two. "I just got out the Ambassador Bible Correspondence Lesson from 1983 on the dramatic return of Jesus and the Battle of Armageddon. This particular correspondence course shows a map of Megiddo and also the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and it is a 55-mile distance difference, as you stated. It states that Megiddo will be the meeting place." Now, this is the correspondence course, stating that the Megiddo will be the meeting place of all the armies of the earth to gather, a mustering place, before they all descend on down to Jerusalem, to the Kidron Valley, or the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where they will fight against Christ at Jerusalem. This reflects pretty much our understanding. He continues, "Christ and the saints will be there, and the beast and all his armies, along with the armies of the earth, will converge on Jerusalem to fight Christ. Christ will not be going to Megiddo to fight the beast. The armies will be coming to Jerusalem after their mustering place at Megiddo to converge on Jerusalem." If you will notice Joel 3, and he gives a number of verses there, it talks about the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and in verse 14 calls it the Valley of Decision and says the day of the Lord is near. The day of the Lord is not at the end of the millennium. Joel 3:13 states, "Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe." Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, corresponding with Revelation 14, 17 to 20. Also, another note, the day of the Lord battle is called in Revelation 16, 14, the battle of the great day of God Almighty. It's not called the Battle of Armageddon. Megiddo is only the gathering place, not where the actual battle is fought. This has been our teaching for decades. Notice Zechariah 14:2, for I will gather all nations to battle against Jerusalem. Also verse 12, the plague on all the people who fight against Jerusalem. Verse 14, Judah also will fight at Jerusalem. I know this is a small point, but I just want to share your thoughts on this and clarify what WCG did teach on this. I have kept much of the old literature and Bible courses from many years back. I don't know if it changed in the liberal years. I'm not sure what they taught then, but let us know what you think. He continues, iron sharpens iron, and it's good to get out the Bibles and dig deep and blow the dust off of it, as we're always told to do. Thanks for helping us to sharpen our spiritual swords and get us thinking. Now we will have to read the resurrection's question and get back to you on this. So this shows that in that correspondence, we're also talking about the resurrections. And what does that have to do with Revelation 14? But this man confirms that people have connected Revelation 14 with the Battle of Armageddon. And like I say, I heard that as a preteen in another denomination. You can go to concordances and find similar positions. That's what people think, that this is talking about the Battle of Armageddon. Even though the instrument used is not a weapon, it's a sickle. There's no reference in that chapter to any physical engagement, like a battle or anything like that. So that's important to notice when we go through it. I want to go through the entire chapter, and I want to point out what it's really talking about and the awareness it gives us of God's plan for mankind, because the whole picture is there. Revelation 14 is comprehensive in the sense that the whole chapter is talking about the same thing. It's also consecutive because it goes through that subject in order. Something to notice before we wade into it. There's seven, we could call them, topic divisions in this particular chapter. And we'll go through them in order. But let's first ask, what is the chapter really about? Now, I have an old Bible that has a heading on top of each of the paragraphs. And the heading that Bible has about this chapter is the harvest of the world. Notice they focus on harvest, not battle. This chapter is talking about the harvests of humanity. And notice there's more than one. Let's go through the chapter quickly, and then we'll comment on various aspects of it. But in the first few verses, we're placed in a time setting. And it says, and I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. With that picture, where are we in time? This obviously is after the second coming. This obviously is after the saints have been raised as spirit beings. They have descended to Mount Zion with him. So we know where we are in time. This is the beginning point in time. Verse 2, and I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. So that tells us the first harvest has already taken place. These are they, verse 4, which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. A major portion of this chapter is devoted to this group of people. Redeemed from the earth, the first fruits unto God. We know who they are. And for this to be the case at this point in time, for this to be the scene that God is presenting, it is obviously after the second coming has taken place, after the saints have been made immortal spirit beings. So that's where we are. So that's the first section of seven in this particular chapter. Now go to verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth, and the sea and the fountains of waters. Who is he talking to? Who is this angel addressing? He's telling them, the people who are living on earth. Now, this isn't the 144,000. This is the rest of the people. Those that are still alive after the end time events, what we call the Great Tribulation. These are those survivors. The angel is saying to them, worship God. Now, that suggests they weren't up to that point in time. And that suggests that they're being given the opportunity to do that. Why would you tell them to do it if they had no opportunity to do it? So here we have survivors of the tribulation still alive who are being told to worship God, and obviously how to, at this point in time. So we are still in the order of events that this chapter presents. So after the 144,000 are seen standing with him on Mount Zion, then the rest of the people are addressed here. And that verse 6 and 7 is the second component in this particular chapter. Now we move on. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Now we know another piece of the time frame. This is after the fall of Babylon. That great city, because she made all nations drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So that's the third segment. Now we move into the fourth in verse 9. Another angel. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. So that's the fourth segment of this particular chapter. And verse 12 is a key verse. Notice what it says. This is speaking to the saints. What saints would there be at this point in time? This is after this message to worship God has gone out. This is after the warning has gone out. This is after the declaration of the fall of Babylon the Great. Who would the saints be at this point in time? Verse 12, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead, which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. Focus on that particular passage, because that is so important. That answers a basic question that the world's religions can't really definitively answer. What is it saying? It's saying it to the saints. It's saying the saints are going to die and rest in their graves until such time. What is that time? That time is described in sequence in the next verse, verse 14. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud. Now we've moved ahead. We've moved beyond the period of time that these verses are talking about. I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man. Who is that? Couldn't be anyone else. Having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. Not a sword, not a spear, not arrows. A sickle. What do you do with a sickle? What do you do with a sickle? In this case, you hold a sheaf of grain in your hand and you sweep that sickle along close to the ground and cut it off intact. That's a harvest instrument. This chapter is talking about a harvest. This is not a battle. There's no rebellion on the part of the people being harvested here. This is talking about the harvest of humanity. Who's doing that harvest? One like the Son of Man. He's harvesting a contingent of people. For what purpose? We can presume that it's for himself. He's talking about the saints who have died, who are resting in their graves, awaiting the time when they're going to be called up to receive the reward that they're due. Verse 15, and another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time is come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. For what purpose? That's the sixth component of this particular chapter. He is reaping those that he wants to bring into his greater family. This is long after the time of the great white throne judgment. That's a period of opportunity for those who never had it. This is long after that. This is not the Battle of Armageddon. That's what people need to understand. Those that have made that connection have sort of distracted themselves from understanding what this chapter is really talking about. Because you see, the Battle of Armageddon is back before verse 1 of this chapter, long before. This is post-millennial. When Christ harvests his latter-day saints, those who come, become converted after the second coming, and that's what this period of time is, those are harvested later. So this chapter tells us there are two harvests. There's an early harvest of just saints, and there's a later harvest of the greater segment of humanity that is going to be harvested by Jesus Christ personally for his family. That's where we are at this point in this chapter. That's what it's telling us. Now, does the world understand that? They've got other ideas. They think it's a matter of heaven or hell at the time of your death. This chapter refutes that idea. That's not how it's going to work out. This is talking about people having their opportunity for conversion, who live and die, and go to their graves and wait for being called up to stand before this white cloud harvest. This is what we could call the final sentencing event. But in verse 17, the mood changes dramatically. The Son of Man is no longer unseen. He's left. He's not mentioned there again. Another angel, it says, came out of the temple, which is in heaven. He also, so this is a different reaping, he also having a sharp sickle. And a companion angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, "Thrust in your sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe." Now we saw in the previous verse that the earth is ripe. That's up there in verse 15. Here again, the situation is such that you can't expect any more ripening. However people are at this point, you couldn't expect them to become any more converted, or you couldn't expect them to become converted. It's just gone that far. This is the time. This is that point in time where he says there will be time no more. All of the answers as to what people are or what they will become, whether converted or not, has been decided. So there's no point in delaying or wasting any more time or carrying on any longer. The earth is ripe, fully ripe. In verse 19, now understand where we are in time. This is the very end of humanity. This is the final sentencing event where all who have ever lived are going to stand alive before the throne of God and are going to be assigned one destiny or another. There's nobody left out by this time. It's the entire picture. Verse 19, and the angel thrust in his sickle unto the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it unto the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city. And blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. Now that's a curious thing to say. Number one, we know that it's going to be in environs of Jerusalem. That's the city being referred to. And we have a depth of blood, maybe 3 or 4 feet deep. And it's going to flow 1,600 furlongs. You know how long that is? That's 200 miles. That takes a lot of blood. Where do you find that many people that would contribute to that much blood flow? That's immense. What is this? What is it telling us? It's basically telling us that this is the point in time when the basic requirement of the payment of sin is accomplished. Now, we've seen the first part of this harvest where the Son of Man takes his contingent out of this group of people. And notice they're commingled. They're together. It's not separate in time. They're not separate in space. They're together. One contingent is reaped, and then the reaper leaves the scene, leaving the rest to these two angels, one with the power of fire. What we have is an answer to a very key question, because where it says, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. So why would this be happening? Simple reason. Those people who are included in the grapes of wrath harvest have not been forgiven of their sins. There's a debt to still pay. They will pay by shedding their own blood. They wouldn't accept Jesus Christ's substitutionary blood. You see what happens here? So they're going to pay for it themselves. And with that accomplished, the huge hanging debt that's out there of humanity will be satisfied. How can God conclude his plan if all of these debts are left unpaid? They have to be satisfied. Now, we've also, when connecting with the Battle of Armageddon idea, thought that, well, maybe this 200 million man army is it. And, you know, the other force that was there already. No, that's not enough people. When you consider the massive amount of bloodshed here in this winepress incident, it tells us it's a much greater number of people than just those who participated in the Battle of Armageddon. It includes all who have ever lived over all time. Their sin debt will be satisfied. And with that accomplished, then the Father can take over the kingdom. So who does that leave? Who's left alive? All those still living at that point in time will have been made spirit beings. That's what happens when Christ reaps his contingent of this harvest from the white cloud. They are made spirit beings. So this particular chapter is very revealing. It tells us a lot of things that the world really doesn't understand. It tells us that there's going to be two harvests, an early one and a later one. Does that correlate with what we understand? But this chapter gives us the whole picture of the plan of God as it relates to the harvests of the world. He is creating, he is processing a harvest. He's gathering to himself those who follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes. That starts right now for people living, if they want to do that. There's those that pass on the opportunity, okay. There'll be a price for that. But this chapter tells us, it gives us the picture. So we have two distinct harvests of humanity. There's nobody left out of this picture. There aren't any people left over who haven't been dealt with. It's all comprehensively there. All are assigned to some appropriate destiny. In Daniel 12:2, we get somewhat of the picture. Daniel 12, again, a very familiar passage, if I can find it. Daniel 12:2. It says that many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. There's two categories of people, and that's the same two categories that we saw dealt with in the latter third of Revelation 14. Isaiah 65:20 also reinforces what we see in Revelation 14, verse 13. Isaiah 65:20. And this also answers a question. What happens to those people who live during the millennium? This particular chapter deals with that time frame. Verse 20. There shall be no more there an infant of days, nor an old man that has not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. This is showing what will happen with people who live during the millennium. Their lives will come to an end. They will have progeny, they will have children, the generations will go on, but people will live and die during the millennium, just like now. That shouldn't be hard to understand, but there's people that speculate otherwise. So we have the questions answered here. And it also shows to us that there's no eternal torment. What we see is complete extinction. That's in Revelation 14, verse 11. We read that. And that's perhaps important to look at. Revelation 14, verse 11. We read over it. Where it says, "And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image and whosoever receives the mark of his name." The beast worshippers are going to be burnt up. And that fire is going to produce smoke. It doesn't say that they are going to be smoking forever. It merely says that that body of smoke that was produced is going to continue and rise up clear out of the earth. It isn't going to settle back down to earth in some form as smoke usually does. This is different. But it doesn't indicate eternal torment. That's the important thing to understand. So we have the white cloud sentencing. That is the final sentencing of the earth. Christ is involved in the first part of that, but not in the great grapes of wrath part. That's left to the angels. Their penalty for sin is paid individually in that it wasn't paid substitutionally. That's the important thing to understand. But that debt will be paid in full. A spiritual equilibrium will be achieved to where death and the grave can be abolished. Revelation 20 tells us about that. With death fully conquered, Christ can then turn over a purified world to the Father that we read of in 1 Corinthians 15. So let's understand, Revelation 14 is not about the Battle of Armageddon. That blood to the horse bridles portion is more than 1,000 years after that battle has been accomplished. Revelation 14 doesn't talk about a battle. It talks about a harvest. It employs a harvest instrument. There's no violence. There's no rebellion. There is no opposition in any of the wording. It's simply people standing to receive the assigned destinies that are appropriate to their spiritual condition. That chapter helps us to understand the picture, the greater picture of what God is doing. It dovetails so perfectly with his plan that's revealed in his holy days. So when you read this chapter, keep in mind of what it's talking about, what its time frame is, and what its overall subject is. The harvests of humanity, which is what God is planning to do.